All right, welcome everyone. Today's speaker is Anupam Mazumdar. It's a pleasure to have him here. It's from University of Groningen, and he's gonna tell us about quantum gravity weakness via entanglement of masses. So please, Anupam.
Thanks, Daniele. And so it's I could see that the audience is from all over, you know, Europe and Canada and America. So it's a wide range. So good afternoon and good evening to everyone. And so I'll be, it's really my pleasure to talk to you, to reach to you, because something is very exciting, as I feel, it's a very exciting moment for gravity and what we are trying to do with quantum gravity and how to witness it via entanglement of masses. So this is something which I'm going to discuss with you and share with you some of the things which we have made some progress, as well as our community has some made progress. And today it's really our pleasure to have Carlo with us, because Carlo has also contributed quite a lot in this direction. So mostly I will be concentrating on the first paper, which we wrote in 1707, and some of the progresses which we have made over a couple of months. And simultaneously, there was also a paper on the same day by Marletto and Wetherell, which appeared on the same day. So you can see that there is a kind of like a new, fresh push to chase this question whether gravity is classical or quantum. So this is the physics which we'll be discussing today. Okay. Let me see if I could. Yeah. So the question is very simple: whether gravity is really classical or quantum. As a theoretical physicist, perhaps we all sympathize that we would love to see gravity to be quantum. There is no reason. I mean, you ask any high energy physicist or theoretical physicist, they will say, look, I mean, you know, gravity has to be quantum, gravity should be quantum. But the question is, how can you show it in a laboratory? And what is the classical and quantum domain where the things become murky? It's a very simple question at the end of the day. But also it's extremely, extremely hard to answer, partly because we know that the gravitational interaction is extremely weak. And that's one of the culprit for us, one of the big problem to probe these kind of questions in a laboratory. And there's also a theoretical blocking. And the theoretical blocking comes that because we know that in general relativity, we have a simple solution, Schwarzschild solution. So if you really want to see something, quantum aspects of gravity, you really have to come very, very close to this Schwarzschild radius. And that's really impossible. So if you really want to see the cuteness of a cat, you have to really approach that limit. But you know that even we cannot reach that limit, first of all. And secondly, if the size of the cat becomes bigger and bigger, so the object, the mass becomes bigger and bigger, actually the cat becomes uglier and uglier. And this is another difficulty uglier in the sense of quantumness. And this is another very hard problem for us, how to really approach this problem. So gravity's Cheshire cat is indeed very, very hard. So, but nevertheless, whatever today we are talking, of course, with our, almost with the theoretical perspective, may sound very much like a science fiction for many of us, but maybe tomorrow it will be a reality. But nevertheless, we can ask many questions. As a theoretician, we can ask this question, these kind of questions. And many stalwarts have asked this question. It's not just I'm posing these questions for the first time. Dyson had asked this question. Feynman had asked this question. Many, many people have asked this question. So can you really put the graviton in a quantum superposition in a laboratory? We have been able to do that for the photons. And of course, that won the Nobel Prize way back in 2010 or 11. When it comes to graviton, the answer is no. It's very, very hard to just take one single graviton and create a spatial superposition of it. Can you study something like I could see Lee has a question. Yes, please, Lee.
No, I just want to emphasize that's something that was understood a long time ago.
I absolutely agree. Absolutely.
You can't hold a graviton in a box.
Yeah.
Because any box that's not collapsed to a black hole, it will leak out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. Thanks for pointing this. So it's the same thing. You can ask a very simple question: that can you mimic like astrophysical black hole? Can you take some two coalescing atoms and study? Of course, there will be huge electromagnetic radiation, but somehow can you subtract that electromagnetic radiation and just see how the graviton loss? But even then, it's very hard because you can do back of the envelope calculation, take the size of the mass of the atoms, and you would see the number of gravitons emitted in this process during the coalescence. It's so small that it will be very hard for you to register it. Mm-hmm. But something which perhaps we can do with a huge optimism, that can we witness quantum entanglement due to quantum nature of a graviton? And the answer is yes. As I said, that by today's standard, it's not easy to do these kind of experiment, but nevertheless, these kind of experiments can be possible tomorrow. And I have had a wonderful discussion with many, many scientific colleagues. All of them are stalwarts in the field of gravity and experimentalists. My colleague, Sugato Bose, with whom I have been discussing this almost for 6-7 years, Ayana and Bjorn Abhay, Carlo is present today. With Carlo, we have had plenty of discussions, and Carlo is leading quite a lot of very interesting calculations in this direction himself. And hopefully he will tell us more about this in future. So there are many, many people who are sympathetic, especially coming from the gravity side, Abhay and others who are very sympathetic towards this. There is also a skepticism from the experimental side, like Marcus Aspelmeier from Vienna, Marcus Arn from this Vienna, and I will talk about a little bit about these issues as well, just to give you some perspective that can we really do this in experiment or not, this kind of experiment, okay? So as I think, just to quote Albert Einstein's famous quote that, you know, things should be made simpler, but no simpler than. So this is, I think, in my opinion, perhaps this is the most simple question we can ask in this game. But even this question itself is very, very hard to answer. So what we are going to discuss today, so we are going to discuss the quantum gravity witness protocol for quantum gravity, how to read that witness, what are the associated challenges, and how can we, you know, overcome some of these challenges in future. And if time permits me, I'll discuss some aspects of quantum gravity, because after all, the theory has to come with experiment. Just to set up the base, we all know, I don't think here we have to say anything about these simple basic stuff. Gravity is universal, extremely, extremely successful. There is no doubt about it. I mean, maybe you can say that on very, very large scales, again, we don't understand fully the nature of gravity, dark energy, and all these kind of problems, but fairly on an intermediate scale, solar system to galactic scales, and to a large extent, cosmological distances. We have understood gravity to a large extent. And general relativity works extremely, extremely well. Of course, having said so, there are some pathologies we know. The singularity problems are there, cosmological singularity, black hole singularity problems. But for the time being, I will not be discussing or interested in these regime. But what bothers me, or many of you, it will bother you, that what kind of constraint do we have, even for simple Newton's potential? Now, of course, Newton's laws are very well valid on a solar system tests, I have confirmed that. But when you come to very small and smaller distances, something like micrometer distances, you see that the level we are constraining 1/r potential, that itself is very, very poor. This is the paper, the plot you can see. This is a paper coming from Adelberger's group. You know, perhaps many of you know Adelberger. He's very well known for his famous torsion-based experiment to see to check 1/r potential. So as experimentalists, what they like to do is that they plot potential with your Yukawa type of correction, e to the power minus r over lambda. Lambda is your length scale, alpha is the strength, and they try to constrain this alpha over lambda parameter. And you see that this is the best, so the blue line, the vertical line I've drawn, so that is the limit today they have placed from Adelberger's group, which is something like 3.8 times 10 raised to minus 5 meters. And if you convert that into some energy scale in the natural units, you find that scale is something like 10 raised to minus 2 electron volt to the power 4. And you see that up to this point, we have tested, or we can say, even the Yukawa potential, to some extent, we have tested it. But beyond that, all the way to the Planck scale, Planckian energy density, we have no clue how the 1/r even works. And having said so, I mean, you know, of course, we make quite a lot of speculations. We make quite a lot of theories. That's fairly good enough, perfectly valid, but still, what haunts us is, how do I probe a very short distance nature of gravity in a laboratory? So having said so, the LSE puts constraints. So LSE puts indirect constraints, and the constraint comes around to be eight to 10 TeV. And that in the length scale, that will correspond to roughly 10 to minus 17 centimeter. But keep in mind that it's an indirect constraint because it comes from the fact that LSE has not seen any Kaluza-Klein excitations. It has not seen any hint of extra dimensions. And from those physics arguments, they put some constraints. So I think many of us will believe that this is a century, this is a decade for gravity, and you have seen how gravity has made progress from LIGO, Virgo, Einstein telescope. Well, the future perhaps it will be the Einstein telescope, which will make huge discoveries, and LISA and the Horizon, Black Hole Horizon has already made some interesting splash. So all this lead to what happens to classical versus quantum aspects of gravity. So even having said so, many people have actually thought about this problem. Long time ago, people have thought about this problem. People have done experiments as well. And one of the famous experiments perhaps everyone knows is the Kao experiment, Kolella, Oberhauser, and Wern experiment. So what they have done is that they have taken the cold neutron and they have measured the phase. So what they have done is that they have treated Earth's gravitational potential as a classical potential, and then they have quantized the cold neutrons. Similar experiment was performed way back in 2000 by Grenoble group, where they have taken the cold neutron and they have allowed the cold neutron to bounce on Earth's surface, and they have quantized, they have seen the energy levels. The reason you can say that, how come we can see such a small phase? Because you immediately realize what enters into the phase is your action divided by H bar. So G in action, you get G, because after all, you're playing with the gravitational Earth's gravitational potential. So G appears there. So the G over H bar, G is a very tiny number. H bar is a very tiny number, but the ratio need not be. So you can tap in a very nice sweet spot where you can measure some of these gravitational induced phases. So that's the beauty about these phases, and people have measured these kind of phases. Now, one of the serious attempts regarding this question about whether to treat gravity, the same footing as your matter, perhaps was raised by Don Page himself. So Don Page and Gilker, perhaps all of you know, there was a famous paper by them, by these colleagues. And before that, there was also another paper by Hanna. I've forgotten their names, but there was another, before Don's paper, there was another paper. The line of argument was very similar. So you treat matter to be quantum, but you take the expectation value of that, but treat gravity purely classically. So it's a kind of like semi-classical gravity. So the idea is that if matter can be put in a spatial superposition, and when you observe it, because of the collapse of your wave function, it will either collapse here or in different part of the universe. Yeah, and then you can measure the gravitational potential. So that's the kind of argument they had floated in their paper. But so what they have said that, yes, the semi-classical treatment of gravity is not a very good, there's not sufficient evidence for that. But what they could not prove that gravity ought to be quantum. So that's the part where they could not go anywhere beyond in their thought experiment or even in the experiment itself. So this is the kind of status we are in right now. We are still playing with quite a lot in theory from semi-classical point of view. But at the end of the day, those who believe in real quantum gravity, they would really like to see that even the metric component should be placed in a quantum superposition. And so how do we do that? But before, let me further add, this is something about primordial gravitational waves. And way back in 2013, 2014, there was a huge splash that BICEP has seen primordial B-mode. And then immediately people were quite interested in asking the same question that, yes, if we had seen, say, let's say, really, primordial gravitational waves, would that be a hint for quantum gravity? And again, it's not a razor sharp kind of argument, because you do get the power spectrum. You can measure the power spectrum. Of course, the BICEP was not the right, because now we know that BICEP's result didn't hold true. But nevertheless, in future, let's say, argument's sake, if we ever see primordial B modes, would we say whether it's really classical quantum? And the answer is still not so clear. Because as I said, in the power spectrum, what enters is the alpha and beta. These are the Bugalyubov coefficients. So what we usually do as a cosmologist, we take the Bunch-Davies vacuum or say squeeze vacuum and put the numbers in to see whether how well do we measure. So what enters is your H bar as well as your Bugalyubov coefficient. But let's say that suppose I'm a completely agnostic. I'm a very much favor of classical physics. Let's, for the argument's sake, if I say, then I can always come up with some very crooked initial classical initial condition to exactly match this power spectrum. So even here, there is no very sharp argument that if we ever see primordial B modes, that has to be quantum in nature. So this is the status we are in right now. So the question is, what is this razor sharp argument? How can we devise a razor sharp argument? So the best way perhaps would be to look for some witness, and the witness should be such that if this, let's say for the argument's sake, if the witness is positive, then you say, look, at the linearized level, gravity ought to be quantum. If the witness is negative, you cannot conclude anything about the experiment. So this is the kind of like argument which we are looking for. So what are the ingredients you would require? So the two key ingredients which we will require is the macroscopic superposition. That's very much important. That's the one of the most important ingredient. And as you can see, if you can place this, the masses in a superposition, in a quantum superposition, and if gravity is quantum, then you are also creating superposition of in curvature as well. So the curvatures are getting localized. So now the question you can ask that, what is the current state of the art? And a couple of day before yesterday, we had a fantastic talk by Marcus Arndt. He's an experimentalist coming from University of Vienna, and they do essentially it's Zeilinger's group and Zeilinger's the prodigies. Marcus Arndt is one of his prodigies who has done amazing experiment with the creating superposition of macroscopic system. And what they have achieved so far in laboratory with the DNA and all sorts of molecules, C60, C70, they have played with all this kind of material and they have gone up to 10 to minus 21 kilograms. So that's the mass they can put in a quantum, in a spatial superposition. But you will see that in order to perform these kind of experiments for quantum gravity purposes, you will see that we would need a huge leap of these numbers. Some 6 or 7 orders of magnitude increase in these numbers we would have to demand. And the second ingredient is the quantum entanglement. Now, quantum entanglement is inherently quantum. There is nothing classical about this entanglement. So you create from a Schrödinger pair production, you create from the vacuum electron and positron, and electron and positron, you cannot talk about electrons wave function and positrons wave function separately. You have to talk in some total of that. So this is an entangled state. And these are two ingredients we would need, key ingredients we would need even to prove or to show that whether gravity can be, whether it really behaves, whether it has some quantum aspects or not. So as I said, that entanglement is very important. And in our community, we know quite a lot about this entanglement and its associated entropy, the von Neumann's entropy, the entanglement entropy. And to be honest, if we are in a quantum world, the only entropy is your entanglement entropy. There's no other entropy. Because you take a system as a whole, A plus B, that will remain be in a pure state. As soon as you divide it, you can create an entanglement between A and B. And you can measure you can take the density matrix, you can take the trace of the density matrix, you can compute the entanglement entropy for either A or B, and you can find the entanglement entropy through this simple calculation. So this is very important. So just to keep you a perspective, simple perspective, because you would say the same question that, look, why chase graviton? Why not chase photon? And people have chased photon. The QED, the strength of and the alpha QED is way too stronger than gravity. But you can see just from your own, from the perspective, that photoelectric effect, it was discovered way back in the early 19th century. And it took almost 80, 90 years to take the photon and create a superposition in wavelengths, in frequencies and polarizations. But this is possible after in 1995, 1996. And this is a picture from the right-hand side you see is from the Max Planck's Institute for Quantum Optics, Rempe's group, where they do, these are now routine experiments. So you see the technology, it takes some time to do the technology, to build the technology, to see really whether a photon is this Schrodinger cat state of a photon. It took such a long time. Now, when it comes to gravity, perhaps it would perhaps be, now you can see the perspective, how difficult the problem is now. So anyway, So I come from slightly from high energy physics, from the gravity side. I was not aware of many of the things which my colleagues were talking about quite a long time ago about in quantum information side. And when I met my friend Bose, he tried to explain me about this famous theorem. And this theorem was laid down by none other than Bennett, who is the father figure of quantum computing. And it has been reviewed in many, many literature, famous theorem. It's called LOCC. Now, what LOCC stands for? So LOCC stands for local operation and classical communication. So what it means, and it can be proven by various mathematical tricks, by measurization and all. I'm not going to go for the mathematical proof. I'm just going to give you the physical argument. So suppose you have got Alice, and imagine that Alice's laboratory is purely quantum. You have got Bob, on the other hand. They are separated, within the same causal patch. They cannot go beyond the causal patch. Within the same causal patch, we have got Bob. Bob has got an apparatus which is purely quantum, but they are communicating with each other through a classical channel. So the theorem states that no matter what happens, as long as they are establishing themselves, each other, through a classical channel, they will not be able to entangle each other. So what it means is that in a very simple language, suppose I give you a coin. Now, coin has got two heads and tails. So imagine that your coin is a quantum coin. So Hilbert space is up and down. Very simple system. I have got a coin which has a Hilbert space up and down. You toss the coin at your end. I toss the coin at my end. And suppose we are establishing our connection through some classical channel, then I will not be able to influence your outcome and you will not be able to influence my outcome. It will always be, the correlation will always be 50-50. But now suppose if I establish a quantum or non-classical channel, let's say, just for the sake of argument, non-classical channel, let it be quantum, then there is a possibility that I will be able to entangle with you and you will be able to entangle with me. So as a consequence, when I toss the coin billion times at my end and you toss the coin billion times at your end, the correlation will not be 50-50, but maybe 51-49 or 50 point something and 49 point something. So that's what the LOCC tells us. So the question is that we need to somehow violate the LOCC in order to establish this quantum connection and to entangle the two systems. So now Alice, you can think about Alice as Alice has got an interferometer, Bob can have his own interferometer, and they can be now talking to each other. And if the gravity is really quantum, non-classical, then you can establish an entanglement between Alice and Bob. So that's the simple logic behind this entire experiment. But before that, let's ask the question, what is the origin of the gravitational potential? Now, as you all know very well, the history of gravitational potential is almost 400 years old from the days of Newton. There's an argument that yes, the potential could be completely classical, as that's what Newton did. I mean, he took the potential to be classical. He matched the data extremely well with the solar system test. There's nothing wrong about that. You can keep that faith very well. But as we understood quantum field, quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, we also now understand that the simple potential can be derived in a quantum mechanical sense or quantum field theory sense through an exchange of a particle, through exchange of some quanta. So the force between two particles, you don't have to assume it now, but you can derive it through a mediator. So this is something very simple, undergraduate level quantum mechanics, nothing very fancy. So if you want to look at the transition matrix between initial and final states, then either you are scattering through your potential. That's the famous experiment, by the way, which was done by Chadwick. He took the gold foil, he took the alpha particles, he bombarded them. He wanted to understand what is the Coulomb potential due to the nucleus. So that's the experiment. So you take the initial state and final state and you do the scattering in a fixed potential. The second term is the one which brings this and all these new features, because now you have an intermediate state J, you're summing over all possible J's, and that's nothing but your mediator. And this mediator has, if you take the all possible configuration of this mediator in the space-time, from the point of view of space-time diagram, you can construct nothing but simple Feynman diagram. So what it tells us that the two ends these are two ends of the vertices where you satisfy your conservation of energy and momentum, but on the other hand, you have got a propagator which becomes off-shell. Off-shell in the sense that it doesn't satisfy your classical equations of motion. So this provides, this optionalness of a graviton provides us a very interesting means, or this is the way perhaps we can test whether this gravity is really classical or quantum, or the graviton here is really classical or quantum. So in the case of LOQC, now you would say the same thing, same scattering phenomena, but now it's happening through off-shell exchange of a graviton. You know very well the graviton propagator around Minkowski space-time, or if you want to perform the experiment in a de sitter or anti-de sitter, you can compute the graviton propagator. You sandwich it in between two and a conserved energy momentum tensor, and you generate your 1/r potential. So it's a very simple, very layman physics at this end. I mean, there's nothing very fancy going on. So what aspects of quantum gravity can we test in a lab, you can ask. So the first one, as I said, is a purely a classical scattering. The second diagram comes from the second order in perturbation theory, where you have the off-shell propagator. And of course, what you would love to see, perhaps some loop effects. And this is, you can actually achieve it. You can achieve it. Suppose you take cosmic string, and as you know, that cosmic string in 3+1 dimensions. So you take a sheet of paper, which has a zero curvature, it's purely a flat space-time here. You cut it through a deficit angle. You take it and from the point you stretch it, you get a cosmic strings. That's the topology of your cosmic strings in 3+1 dimensions. So cosmic strings, if you take two cosmic strings, they don't have any tree level potential. The only way they interact is through one loop. And there's a very nice paper by Mark Wise who had done this calculation way back in 2004, where he computed exactly this potential in a very interesting manner. So of course, we would love to test all these kind of effects, that even the way the one loop comes into the game. But you see that the experimentally what is viable is, you can see that what appears in your phase, in your entanglement phase. So entanglement phase, both for classical and quantum, the simple off-shell exchange will give you G over H bar effect. But if you want to do this, play with the same game with the infinite cosmic strings, the effect goes as G square. And that is the one which kills us, because G square is such a tiny number that seeing this effect would be extremely, extremely hard in any laboratory. But nevertheless, maybe it's possible. One day this kind of experiments could be possible. So one fine print in any quantum experiment which you do is that you always play with the off-shell process. If you create a beam splitter, if you have a diffraction pattern, all of these introduce some optionalness in your, even a very simple quantum experiment. So optionalness is a very critical aspect, which perhaps we can potentially test in this kind of experiments. So as I said, let's go back to...
I have a simple question about...
Sure.
Well, I'm thinking even the Newton potential, which is a classical phenomena, but classical from the point of view of the field, is completely quantum from the point of view of the particle, because it's off-shell.
Absolutely.
And so the notion of classical or quantum, there's no absolute notion of classical and quantum. It's relative to the media.
You're absolutely correct. You're absolutely correct, Ilona.
Okay. So it goes back to a question which at that time I didn't dare asking because it sounded too naive. It's like talk about this LOCC, you talk about classical operation. And I was like, okay, what do you even mean by that? Like, can you even mathematically define what you mean by classical operation?
Yeah, let's say that I'm talking to you right now. And let's say that I'm talking through, not through, say, electromagnetic radiation. After all, we are digitizing it. And let's say we are talking through sound wave, which is not really quantized, which we are not quantizing it. So just to give an...
I know that in the case where I assume there's a classical, maybe it's beyond what you talk. In a way where I assume there's classical reality, then people kind of assume that it's clear what I mean by classical. But here we just pointed out something, is that, in fact, the Newtonian potential, depending on how you look, it's maybe the most quantum object, or it's very classical. So the notion of, when you interact by the Newton potential, if I take the particle picture, I would say it's a quantum effect. Then I can
Absolutely.
Take, so it's both, which is the beauty of it.
It's both, but this is the point. Like, can we test it?
Okay.
This is what I'm after.
Can I interject with just one point and try to answer, Laurent, because this was discussed in the community. Whatever the variables you use, you cannot entangle two systems unless the the mediator has two variables that do not commute.
That's true.
So in this precise sense, you need a quantum thing. So it doesn't matter what is a variable that you use, but if you you have only one, so the value of the potential, the position of the particle, you cannot entangle.
Yeah.
You need two non-commuting variables to have a...
Absolutely. What you're saying, Carlo, is absolutely correct. I agree with
you. Now, the question is for the virtual particle, which is not a particle. What is that guy really? It's not like analyzing any, neither X nor P, anyway.
One virtual particle is not sufficient to entangle. You have to have two non-commuting variables describing it.
And this is the place is becoming very interesting. Now suppose, I mean, this is what I think Carlo has been emphasizing a lot, that can we test even beyond linearized quantum gravity? And that will be even better because we open a new scope. If there is something even about non-perturbative quantum gravity is operated or is or operating, can we really test that? Because after all, what Carlo says is a very interesting point that I'm giving an example of an off-shell, but I could replace this off-shell by something else as well, which is non-commutating. And that's the place where we can open up new direction altogether. So I absolutely agree with what Carlo just pointed out to us. So yeah, where I was. Yeah, so coming back to this game now. So you see that Alice has got the interferometer. Bob has now got the interferometer. And in between, if whatever the quantum entities, it could be, I mean, doesn't matter. It can now be photon, it can be graviton. Of course, we are interested in gravity, and so it has to be graviton, or maybe some aspects of quantum gravity. It doesn't have to be linearized quantum gravity. It could also be nonlinear quantum gravity also. Some kind of loop quantum gravity or some other formulation of quantum gravity could enter into the game now. They would be able to entangle Alice and Bob's interferometer. So exactly the coin. So I toss the coins. So you have a coin and I have a coin. But if there is a quantum interaction between us, I can measure the correlation. So what is important here, the witnessing is the correlation. You witness how many times you are getting heads up and tails down. So if it's 50-50, we know that it is a classical correlation. But if it's not 50-50, then you know it's a quantum correlation. And as soon as you got a quantum correlation, you can build all sorts of witness, entanglement-based witnesses. And this is something which I will talk to you now. But one of the technical thing which you will, if you want to do this in an experiment, in a laboratory, what you need to do is that you really need to embed spin in the system because you know that spin is a measure. I can measure spin up and spin down, like in a Stern-Gerlach experiment. So spin acts like my ruler. So that helps us to, you know, do the experiment. So this is the experimental setup. So I have got two masses. I can, I embed a spin inside these masses, and I let it go, undergo the Stern-Gerlach setup, Stern-Gerlach inhomogeneous magnetic field. I bring it back, I do a closed loop essentially, one closed loop, and then I measure the correlation between the spins. How many times I have got a spin up and spin down? If it's 50-50, as I said, that it will be purely classical correlation. If it's different from 50-50, then you know that there is some non-classical correlation has been established between Alice's and Bob's interferometer. So you can measure the entanglement phase. It's very simple calculation, one line calculation to measure how the state has evolved. So the dotted line is your superposition, and the superposition, just for simple argument, you take this to be delta x, the center of mass distance to be d, and these are the left and right states because you're playing with spin up and spin down, and you can measure the entanglement phase. And you can construct the entanglement witness as well. And the witness is given here by W is the same witness with John Bell used for the Bell's inequality. So it's no different witness we have taken in the very first paper, but you can improve the witness. So there are various ways now people are improving the witness, which witness is much more efficient to measure and things like that. But nevertheless, so in this particular basis, the Bell's basis, if W is bigger than one, then you can say, whether it's an off-shell graviton or any version of quantum gravity which enters into this game ought to be quantum, has to be quantum in nature. And if you want to measure the phase in a laboratory, so these are the numbers which we came around at the time when we calculated the numbers. you would require 10 to minus 14 kilogram masses. And as I said, that Marcus Arndt's group in Vienna, they have done the experiment with 10 to minus 21 kilograms, and you see that it's a tall order. So 7 orders of magnitude of improvement we would require in order to really perform this experiment. So technology-wise, we are nowhere close to perform this kind of experiment, but keep an eye on perspective of LIGO. What was LIGO, say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago, and what it is now? So maybe if we start, if we put the stepping stone now, very small stepping stone, maybe after 30 years or 20 years with the technological improvement, maybe we will be able to reach these numbers and perform this kind of experiments. So you have to keep the superposition for roughly 1 second. The delta X has to be roughly around 100 microns. So these are all tall orders. And again, G over H bar appears. G is a tiny number, H bar is a tiny number. So there are some sweet spots. So the phase we demand to be order one, and there is another reason phase we demand to be order one. I mean, in experiment, you can measure phase even less than order one. So order one phase is required because you will see that even these two masses, although they are neutral, but they are made up of some material. And these materials, let's say diamond or silica, whatever you pick up, it has a diamagnetism. And as soon as you have diamagnetism or some other material properties, they start interacting even via electromagnetism. And so you get your Casimir interaction. So Casimir interaction becomes your huge background between the two spheres. And that actually overdominates over even gravitational potential. So you have to make sure that the gravitational potential or the gravitational, you know, this entanglement phase is bigger, at least by order of magnitude or 10 orders, 10 times than your Casimir. So this parameter range can make sure of that your Casimir is a subdominant and you can measure the entanglement phase, gravitational entanglement phase. But even having said so, these are very tall orders. Now the question is, if you really want to engineer it, can you improve these numbers or not? So for the rest of my time, I'll be talking about a little bit about the experimental side and what we have made some progress in this direction with other people, other groups have made some progress. I'll just review very quickly. So, as I said, that you can do a basis-dependent witness. It is always basis-dependent, and you can change your basis. So right now, the preferred basis was given by a few quantum information people. One of my collaborators involved in this is Kim, who has given this witness, which turns out to be slightly better than the Bell's witness. And as I said, that if you don't want any basis-dependent witness, you can measure directly the von Neumann's entropy. And that entropy you can measure by looking into all possible correlation. So sigma x, sigma x, sigma x, sigma y, sigma x, sigma z, you prepare all possible correlation, and you can, if you can measure all possible correlation, you can even look for the entanglement entropy. But having said so, there are many, many problems in order to do these kind of experiments. You have to neutralize it. You have to make it electromagnetic neutral. You have to, initially, you would require a huge amount of magnetic field to create this macroscopic superposition. It's almost like your LHC now. So LHC, you're taking you're accelerating a charged particle. Here, you have to accelerate almost a neutral particle with a spin. And you require very sophisticated technology that how can you create this superposition? That itself is very, very challenging. And not only that, the huge amount of condensed matter physics enters because suppose you take diamond, inside diamond you have phonon, and the phonon can destroy the spin coherence. So you have to take into account of that decoherence effects due to phonon. The phonon interacts the spin and that will dephase this coherence essentially. So in order to do that, you have to cool down from the inside of your diamond as well as the chamber. The chamber has to be cooled to roughly around 1 Kelvin temperature. Inside the diamonds, if you take diamond, they have to be cooled below 77 Kelvins or so, so that the phonon noise can be minimized. And not only that, you have to perform this kind of experiment where there is no collisional decoherence, because even the best of vacuum will have some, you know, molecule, some atom, something. That if that hits your system, your macroscopic superposition, that will also destroy coherence. So all these things are going against your experiment. But now the question is, how can you minimize this? It's like damaging your control. How can you damage all these controls and still perform this experiment, whether it's in space or on Earth, if you want to do it, where would you like to do this experiment? So what we realize that immediately that Casimir is very interesting because you are learning something about something about vacuum. This is your biggest, essentially, your background for measuring gravitational force. But you can mitigate that. You can mitigate that by putting a conducting plate. So you don't have a Casimir between the two spheres, but what you have now, the Casimir is between the sphere and the plate on your left-hand side and on the right-hand side. So apparently if you do this calculation, so there is a Casimir, you cannot completely mitigate it, completely nullify it, but you can mitigate the situation, and it's possible to do that. And it improves your parameter space. And improves your parameter space in such a way that you don't require such a very large macroscopic superposition. So initially we require 200 micrometers. You can bring it down to 20 micrometers, which is a lot more, you know, it's a nicer number than a large macroscopic superposition. The pressure of your chamber doesn't have to be 10 to the minus 16 Pascal. You can bring it down by one order of magnitude to 10 to the minus 15 Pascal. Initially we thought that we would require 10 to the minus 14 kilogram masses to be in superposition. We can bring it down to something like 10 to the minus 16, 10 to the minus 15. But then what happens is that in this, for these range of masses, these range of parameters, you can perform the experiment without too much worrying from the Casimir aspect, but then the phase becomes less than one. Phase becomes roughly 0.01 or 0.001. So what it means is that you would really need to repeat the experiment. Suppose it's 0.01, you would repeat 1 over square root of n. So it means you have to repeat the experiment 10 to 4 times or 10 to 5 times to get the same effect as order 1 phase. So you see that you try to control something, you try to mitigate something, but the other things also bite you. But this is the nature of experiment. So you can perform, so as I said, that now we are taking into account of all sorts of things because, you know, Stern-Gerlach is essentially your wire. And that's the one which is producing you current, but the wire gets heated. So you cannot place a wire like this because the heat is so much that it will snap the wire. It's because you need to accelerate it. So you have to take that into account. So once you have let the current running through the wire, it will also emit your black body emission. So the black body emission and black body absorption due to this superposition, that can also destroy your coherence. So you have to minimize all this kind of, all the decoherence sources of decoherence. So just to give an illustration, so what we have realized that you really have to control your vacuum. The number density of the vacuum has to be very, very well controlled, which in your x-axis is a number density of a vacuum. And the dotted line is the one which sets all the decoherence rates. And so all the decoherence rates should be smaller than the entanglement phase. So that's something which you have to make sure. So right now we are playing with the number, which is something like 0.075. If you take the system to be really diamond, and if you take all the properties of a diamond. So these are very daunting tasks. The temperature of the inside the chamber has to be roughly 1 Kelvin. All these things for the 10 to the minus 15 kilogram masses. So all these things are really, really demanding things. But nevertheless, there is a possibility that we can really perform these kind of experiments. You can also ask, what happens to the graviton? The box itself has gravitons. Even the experimental box, would that really destroy your coherence? And you can compute this decoherence rate or dephasing rate. Essentially, this is the scattering diagram, the graviton hitting your macroscopic superposition. And you can, so many people do various kind of modeling, purely quantum field theory models. There are models which are stochastic based models. And what quantum field theory model, what it gives us that the induced decoherence is way too small because one can immediately understand because it goes by the G Newton. So suppose the macroscopic superposition has a frequency which is omega m. So T Planck is your Planckian time. So the omega has to be very, very close to Planckian time to really decohere the system. If the omega is not as large as your Planckian scale, then the decoherence rate is also very, very small. So this is not really a threat for the experiment as such. But nevertheless, you can ask exactly the kind of question which LIGO had to ask, that what happens if there's a butterfly passes by, would it really destroy my experiment? The answer is yes. If the car is passing by, if I'm moving, if a slow motion, if I have a continuous or jerk motion, then would that really destroy the coherence of your system? If there's seismic noise, atmospheric noise, all kinds of questions you can ask, and they will destroy the coherence of your system. So essentially it's a finite size effect, because after all, you're performing the experiment in a finite chamber, and this chamber has a certain size. And also if you're performing the experiment on Earth, there is a Coriolis force which you have to take into account. So everything can lead to spoiling your coherence of your system. So you have to make sure that your entanglement phase is larger than all possible decoherence sources, non-inertial forces, the jitters, the gravity gradient noise. If I perform the experiment in CERN, then I have to worry the Lake Geneva, whether it in the day and night, or maybe in the winter and summer, how it changes the height, the depth. So all sorts of things I need to worry about. So this is a plot on your left-hand side. You can see that suppose you take the mass of the system, mass of the box, not the system, something like 10^2 grams. And if you take the size of the box to be where the experiment has to be performed, roughly of the order of say 1 meter or 0.9 meters. This is the, and you can see that the red blob, that's your ZAM capsule. So in Bremen, there's a drop tower experiment. So the ideal thing would be to do it in a drop tower experiment where you can nullify the effects, some of these effects. So you measure only the gravitational entanglement between the masses, and there are no other effects which are going to spoil your coherence of the system. So in principle, we can perform the experiment in ZAM, but then we have to worry upon other kind of noises. As I said, there are seismic noises, there are jerks, there are cars moving, there's a plane going, that will also destroy the coherence. And Kip Thorne had a wonderful paper. So he had written two papers in the context of LIGO. One was with his wife, actually, where they discussed the human motion. Suppose if I'm moving around, will it really change, destroy your, will it affect your LIGO experiment? So similar kind of questions we had to raise here as well. And we followed Kip Thorne's, those two beautiful papers to compute all these kind of gravity gradient noise, the jitters and all. And what we find that there is an exclusion zone. So if you want to perform this experiment, you have to exclude, you have to have an exclusion zone. And one of the dangerous one comes essentially from the jerks, all of a sudden motion. Suppose I pick a hammer and just drop it, we'll give a huge jerk, it will destroy the coherence of your system. And all these things gives you some, as I said, some exclusion zone, and you have to perform the experiment something like 5 to 10 meters away. And so there should be nothing. There should not be any source of disturbance in 5 to 10 meters. And if you want to avoid any seismic noises or anything like that, you really have to perform the experiment or drop tower underground. So you take a drop tower, let it fall, so 50 to 100 meters. The size of the system, experimental system, has to be 5 to 10 meters. Even your all the heating devices, cooling devices, refrigeration devices has to be away from 5 to 10 meters. So in some sense, it's a very, very daunting experiment. And underground, the seismic noise is very low. That's one of the reasons why LIGO experiments and Einstein telescope experiments are going to be, I mean, they're doing all these experiments underground. So essentially, these are all daunting tasks. But one of the other daunting challenge for us is that how do you create this such a super large superposition? If you play with a diamond, then you have to take into account of all possible properties, the material properties of a diamond. The diamagnetic potential is there, the envy center potential is there, the one which is felt by the spin. So you have to take all these essential, the entire Hamiltonian, and then you have to create how could I get a large macroscopic superposition. So there are this is a genuine challenge. So far, the technology is still not there. We are still working on how to create this large superposition, but the answer, the very short answer is that it is possible to perform such a large superposition. Either you can coat the diamond with the helium, where you can nullify some of these diamagnetic, so essentially the third term, which is diamagnetic part, you can nullify it because helium doesn't have such a large diamagnetic term. So, You can play the engineering part. You can do it. So I'm not so worried upon how to get such a large superposition. It is possible to do it, but also there are other challenges, as I said. But not only gravitational quantum gravity effects. You can also measure gravitational waves. Just take a single interferometer. If you create a large superposition, roughly delta, if you take delta x to be roughly around 1 meter, you can actually have a subhertz gravitational wave detector because it's a very sensitive device. It's a perfect accelerometer. You can measure any small acceleration or any small strain in your space-time. So in some sense, it can open a new window of opportunity for us in the subhertz gravitational waves. But besides this, there are also various theoretical applications, and I know that most of you, all of you, are perhaps theorists there. And one of the beautiful aspects which we have learned from this kind of experiment is that, which theorists already knew from the very beginning, that if we are really quantum, if the gravity is inherently quantum, then essentially we are all entangled. So in some sense, you can entangle the entire system. So or if you take n particles, all these n particles are now entangled, neutral particles are getting entangled just purely with gravity. Of course, there are other sources of entanglement because of photon interaction, gluon interaction, weak interaction, W and Z, all sorts of things will entangle you, but inherently, universally, you will always get entangled if gravity is really quantum. So now you can build a tensor network. So you can take n particles and let the n particles do all sorts of interesting things under gravitational potential, under the influence of gravity. And if gravity is quantum, then they are all entangled. So that's the beauty about from the theory perspective. And so this kind of experiment also allows us to probe now ultraviolet aspects of gravity. And you can probe now short distance. Suppose you modify, you want to build phenomenology. If you want to go beyond GR, you take wild gravity, you take some F of R gravity, or you take some other gravity, you can at least modify the graviton propagator. And from there, you can actually even probe short distance nature of gravity as well, how the short distance nature of 1/r potential changes. And as I said, that Carlo has been leading some very interesting computations where essentially he's not taking this off-shell part of the graviton, but he's replacing that by something inherently, as he pointed out, that as long as you have non-commutating observables, he's replacing that with some non-commutating observable that could come maybe from loop quantum gravity effects, or maybe triangulation of space-time, and even that could perhaps lead to some interesting result, in my opinion. So having said so, as I said, that if you modify gravity, if you modify the nature of Newton's potential, you can measure the entanglement phase, you can measure the entanglement entropy. And just to give you an example, so in the Newton's case, because you have just 1/r potential, the entanglement will keep increasing. But if you can soften the gravity in the UV somehow, then you can change the entanglement entropy as well. So one very interesting experiment which you can do, a thought experiment, suppose you take two quantum systems, let's take two masses separated by a certain distance. You can ask the question, if these masses are quantum and if the gravity is quantum, how this what is the rate of growth of entanglement? So you can perform this calculation in a 1D system, 2D system, and 3D systems. And so here I've shown you in the below plot, 1D and 3D, and you can see there's a universality. Even for 1D and 3D, you see that it also happens for 2D as well, but I have not shown it. The rate of growth of entanglement entropy is extremely, extremely slow. It's a logarithmic growth. So that is, again, something very interesting, theoretical aspects you learn, that in the infrared entanglement is very, very weak. It's a logarithmic growth of your entanglement entropy. So I'm coming almost close to my talk. So as I said, that there's one setup which can actually does many things. It can probe condensed matter, atom optics, trapping, levitation techniques, cooling techniques. You can learn something about the Casimir and patch potentials, very, very low temperatures at like 1 Kelvin, 2 Kelvin, where there's no experiment exists right now. The Casimir effects have never gone into the regime where temperature is around 1 Kelvin. They always do at much higher temperatures. So you can understand the basic decoherences, the material science aspects, you can understand quantum field theory, you can perform an experiment even to measure the light cone structure even. And not only that, you can also probe physics beyond the Stan model. Say for instance, if you have axions, if you have extra hidden sector photons, you replace this neutral system by a charge ion, then you are sensitive to even one loop effects in QED. And so you can measure some of these effects very well. I don't have much time perhaps to talk to you all about all these very interesting constraints, but you can do many, many things with this. So let me conclude my talk. I have already taken quite a lot of your time. So the conclusion is a very simple test. So don't think that it's going to do only test the quantum aspects of gravity, but it can perhaps do many things. As I said, as I highlighted, that's one experiment which can bind many, many different aspects of physics. So I believe that I think if the community is favorable, then I think we have to, this is the time we have to put the stepping stone, and perhaps we can start something, a very interesting program for the future. So with this, let me thank all of you. Thanks for your patience, and asking very interesting questions, but please do ask me further questions if you have. Thanks.
All right, thank you Anupam for the nice talk. And so let's start with the questions. Hank has a question.
Yep, hello.
Hello, yeah.
Yeah, thank you for the interesting talk. And if I took away the sort of the main point of the obstacles, I guess, mm-hmm. to the experiments, is that it's way too sensitive to decoherence.
Yeah.
Like any small perturbation can decohere
a bottleneck, yes.
Yes. So I was wondering, like, if you use entangled topological anions, for example.
No, I have not, but it's an interesting question. Yes, you can now mm-hmm. think about that if you want to replace this off-shell by some other quantum aspects, could you really, entangle the two systems? So it's right. a wonderful mm-hmm. question. Perfectly wonderful question, I would say.
Thank you. So it's because, topological states are protected against mm-hmm. these perturbations. So yeah. I was wondering if it makes their experiment more robust in a sense.
It can, yeah. Yeah, no, I think any such idea, I would definitely, if you have some more thought about this, I would be very glad to listen to you. And if you send me some drops or some lines or some, what you have in mind, definitely we should all, anyone should explore it, these kind of questions. Wonderful. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you.
Laura?
I have a few questions. Sure. One is about LISA. So what is the prospect of, for these type of experiments with LISA coming up?
You see, it would be wonderful if one can place, your question is wonderful. I love this question. If you can place this system in a Lagrange point, of course, the LISA is perhaps one of the best place where you can perform this kind of experiments. But the problem is that, right now, the LISA is going to get launched in 2030, 2035. And to be honest with you, that in 15 years time, we will develop the technology, mm-hmm. but maybe we can be a bit shy of that.
So maybe what I'm asking is, as a quantum gravity technology, can we make sure that we are in the blueprint of LISA, that is, mm-hmm. quantum gravity experiment, are and what should we do as a community to?
I would love this, yeah, because
you were asking to brainstorm yeah. such that when LISA becomes a realistic technology, maybe one of the first things they it's designed for, it's not what it's designed for now, but. If you have any suggestion,
With LISA, the question will be, you have to really create the superposition, you see, for this kind of experiment. Mm-hmm. There could be other indirect way of testing quantum aspects of gravity with LISA. I'm not denying that. Maybe there are, there would be. But performing this kind of experiment, it would be slightly hard right now with LISA.
Yeah, this exact design, I know. But yeah. What I'm saying is that maybe we can start a conversation.
No, but I think as a community, I'm reaching out to all of you, because I think this is the time where we should think upon it, and we should try to see if we can perform some kind of like a razor sharp kind of like experiment. And that would be wonderful. We need that, actually. As a community, we need it.
I agree. So maybe it's a non-scientific question. So what is the vector of that? Like, do we need to create a new society? Of
course, I would love that.
Do we need to, what's the, anyway,
No, you're asking a wonderful question, because to be honest, we need this kind of like support. Mm-hmm. We need to build a community. Mm-hmm. We need some young people who could come in and join in. And, we have to build a community. And this is what I'm doing, actually. I've just started it. Mm-hmm. Trust me that in CERN, something very interesting thing happening now. The CERN has opened a quantum computing division. And even I have approached the director of the quantum computing division of CERN and asking, requesting him whether, we could do some such experiment in future in CERN, because one of the things we require is a vacuum. And CERN knows how to create one of the best vacuum in the world. Of course, now LIGO is also doing this similar game, and LIGO has maintained the vacuum on an even larger scale. So some of these techniques we can learn from CERN and LIGO experiment. All this GGN calculation, the gravity gradient noise, I learned it from Kip Thorne's paper, essentially. So I'm borrowing quite a lot of technology from these, all these great stalwarts. But right now, I think what we lack, to be honest, is this coherent effort from a community. And in Perimeter Institute, there's a huge, quantum gravity group, theory group. And if we could all join hands together, if we could, maybe the first step will be to write a white paper and then take this white paper to each and every individual country's agencies and say that, could we get some support? Any support is good enough to perform, as a seed money. To be honest, we don't even have that seed money. So any help would be good help. Any penny will add up to science here. So you're asking the right question. So I'm very happy to, if you have something, some good suggestion, please. I mean, let me know. I would be very happy to. We are trying to build some community, and I would be glad to have such community.
Let's keep the conversation. I have another question, if somebody, which is something that came up very rapidly at the end. I'm really deeply interested personally. For me, I think the phenomenology of quantum gravity is not going to be in the UV. It's going to be in the infrared.
Exactly.
But okay, it's a long story why I believe that. So I think you kind of, one of the reasons you would say is that gravity is the only force that doesn't admit any screening. And then there's a lot of recent work on, let's say, edge mode. It has a lot. I mean, as you say, we are all, if gravity is quantum, we're all entangled. Yeah. And the vector of entanglement are really soft modes, right? They're the soft gravitons.
Absolutely.
The soft gravitons are not detected, they have huge collective motion and then huge collective ability. So, you were saying that, oh, well, if we go a long distance, there's no entanglement. That was, how much of that is model dependent? How much of that is robust? I'm not saying it's easy to find out this infrared test. But
I think Gordon Semenoff has been doing quite a lot of calculation, and I think Rob Mann has also been doing quite a lot of interesting computation with the very soft gravitons. So these soft gravitons would be entangled with the hard particles.
Yeah.
So essentially, we are also playing with essentially the soft graviton. This 1/r effect is effectively offshell. But even the onshell soft graviton will also get entangled. Mm-hmm. And one can compute this entanglement entropy.
Yeah, and you were saying it decays very fast. Is that, model dependent? Or
the rate of entanglement is very slow because of the gravitational nature, 1/r, the rate of growth of entanglement is very small. So what I was saying this part. So you can see in my slide. So if you take two gravitating system and treat them quantum superposition, then what we have found that where n is the number of sides, so number of, let's say, spin states. Yeah. So for 1D, there is only 10 spin states are there, 2,500, you can do this calculation. And what we found that the rate of growth of entanglement entropy has a universality behavior, some kind of universality. As you can see that even if you increase the values of n on your left-hand side plot in the down below, you see that the universality. Similar universality we have found even for 3D systems. So we had to do this numerically because, it's not easy to do all this analytically because as the number of sites increases, the computation increases. So here we could go up to 6³. So there are 6 sites with in the 3 dimensions. And we found that, again, the growth of entanglement entropies, again, has the universality. So this is the universality which I was talking about. And it's very slow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
And Lee has a question.
Yes, I've got two questions.
Sure.
The form of what if you could. What if you could detect parity odd modes of the gravitational force or gravitational potential? There are a number of ideas about quantum gravity that put some interesting behavior in the parity odd mode.
Yeah.
Is there any, and maybe that would be cleaner than the parity even mode in terms of decoherence and so forth.
But the point is, how would you perform the experiment? What kind of experiment do you have?
I'm asking you. We could think about it.
No, it's a good question. I haven't really thought about how would you set up the experiment to understand the parity odd. Either you go for a higher derivative gravity. Is something which you have.
That's one of the ideas. Use Pontryagin invariant.
That's true. No, I think your point is absolutely correct. But the problem, not the problem. The question is a beautiful question, and it's theoretically well posed question. And you can actually do it. But my suspicion here is now, I mean, this is I'm guessing right now, is that because it's a higher derivative term, the propagator suppression will be large. And
well, it might not be a higher derivative term.
Pardon me?
It might not be a higher derivative
term. Oh, if it is not higher derivative term, then the chances are good that you may be able to see some entanglement, some different entanglement and witness. Entanglement phase, yeah. If you can find a difference in the entanglement phase, that will be very interesting. That would be very interesting.
Okay, and I'm one of the people who thinks that the interesting quantum gravity phenomenology is going to be in the infrared, but because of MOND and the evidence from MOND and the apparent coincidence between the scale of MOND and the cosmological constant scale, and then the coincidence of those scales with the weak interaction, the neutrino mass difference scale. So I'm just trying to hopefully get some, talk at you until you say something interesting in response.
No, I think these are all very good evidences, but now what, I mean, actually the question is that, would they be a very sharp, you know, test or not? That's what we are looking at. I mean, we are looking for something which is very sharp, which we can say that if the witness is positive or negative, you say something about it. Right. But if there is nothing, then okay, it's fair enough. We cannot conclude. Well,
with the B mode detection, would you say that would be sharp or?
No, I would say again, I mean, I would love to see even the B mode and would like to accept that it's quantum in nature. But if I'm very, very skeptic, suppose I come from those camp of people where people say that no, only classical gravity exists. They can always come and tell me that, look, I can come up with, I can mimic the initial state purely classically. It may be baroque, it may be very hideous, but I can mimic it. So again, this is not a very razor sharp, and that's the place where I can, someone can bite me.
Right, okay, thank you.
No, you're welcome. So yeah, and one of the reason I'm reaching to all of you in Perimeter is that if we could, as a community, if you could do something or not. And believe me, in a snow mass meeting in America, there are already a few people, few camps from MIT and NIST. They have already had a discussion session and they are thinking about, of course, some funding and all sorts of things. So I think as a community, these are very wonderful news. I think we love that. If we can join all our hands, the technology part as well as the theory, I think it will be a win-win situation for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There is Rishabh.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask you about the self-gravitating mass where you calculated the entanglement entropy and its evolution with time. Could you talk about the initial states and the interaction which you were taking there? I probably missed this part.
Sure. I can point. Okay, maybe this plot with the Casimir, if you take it. So if you insert the Casimir plate, then if you see the left-hand side on the so on the top panel, so there are a few interactions. The color-coded as black one is for roughly for 3 second interaction, and I think the purple one is roughly for 1 second. So 1 second is just the interaction time for building the entanglement entropy, but the entire experiment has to be done. You have to finish it in roughly 2 to 3 seconds. So you create this, superposition, and then you let it entangle. It's always entangling. Once you have created the superposition, right, it's entangling.
And, okay, so the ones afterwards, the plot afterwards are the same as these ones?
Yeah, it's a good point. So the left-hand side of the plot has a slightly different magnetic field strength, 10 to 6 Tesla per meter. On the right-hand side, the plot has 10 to 4 Tesla per meter. And so we are looking at slightly different parameter space. We are doing some parameter search now to perform this kind of experiment and what is feasible by the experiment list.
So okay. I was actually talking about the plots at the very end of the presentation.
Which is, you mean?
These ones.
Oh, yeah. I see. So could you repeat your question? So then,
what were the initial states and what was the interaction? Did you do this with a specific Hamiltonian,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So we can say a Gaussian state. So let's take coherent states.
Okay.
And but you can repeat it now with a squeeze state or any different state you wish. You can repeat this kind of calculation, and that will be nice. It will be nice check also how the entanglement entropy grows with time. It would be a nice check. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I have another question.
Yes, please.
So it's about, if you go back to your initial picture about the key experiment you want to do there, which is in terms of spin somehow. And I was trying to think about the power of the large number n. So one thing where gravity, you know, of course it's very weak, but one place where it wins over electromagnetism is that in electromagnetism, you have the phenomena of screening. So it's very, very hard to grow large charges because plus minus at the end of the day, it's near zero, right? So that's why we talk about quantum on individual aspect. Now, you know, mass has the property that it's always positive. So therefore, you know, it adds up. So somehow there should be, you know, I don't know what is the design, but there should be an experiment that really uses this power of gravity that it doesn't screen itself, right? So that n can be very large, and maybe, so I'm thinking naively, you know, if you have a quantum crystal and then you bombard it with a quantum particle, it's going to create a superposition. Of course, it's not yet this, you know, you want that system to interact with itself or something like that, but You see where I'm going? It seems to me that in the presentation, there's maybe one aspect which is missing, which is the large n, the side of this experiment.
Yeah. So in some sense, large n, you are correct that you need to boost the mass. So that's why you have to go to such a heavy mass. So creating superposition also becomes challenging for very super heavy masses. So we could, as I said, that in the Marcus Arns group, that's what they are trying with the, even they are trying with the COVID. They are thinking to perform an experiment with the COVID-19 virus to create a macroscopic superposition. But their mass ranges are something like 10 to minus 20 to minus 21 kilograms.
But what about something like the Mausbauer effect? You know, if I have a quantum particle and I hit a crystal, I mean, I'm going to create a superposition. What's hard is to harness, because it's a superposition of a lot of atoms that are, you know, that carry a very small quantum displacement. Now, you know, the second part of that experiment that you want to measure the superposition of the field, but I think it is possible to create this, you know, bombarding.
I think the witnessing becomes very, very hard.
Yeah, the witnessing. Okay, now I understand, but maybe there is some, I don't know, maybe you can do, anyway, there I'm going beyond my... I'm thinking about having a quantum system that is time delayed, so you make it interact with itself or something. What I'm thinking is that the type of technology that we have devised, which are quantum, are usually, you know, they're not thinking about big system because of the screening.
Yeah.
So gravity is very special in that sense.
Gravity is indeed very special. It's universal. So many of these properties we can perhaps perform this experiment. So in principle, LIGO would be a perfectly good example. But the LIGO, the mass of the mirrors are so heavy that we cannot create a superposition and for sufficiently long enough time. Mm-hmm. Imagine if you could create a macroscopic superposition with LIGO's mirrors, that would be fantastic. That itself would be fantastic.
No, LIGO is not really designed for that, but maybe, you know, doesn't mean that, there's not a possible design of...
No, that's true.
Jericho crystal or... Yeah. I mean, anyway.
Okay, more questions?
I have a...
Yeah.
If there are no... Other questions, I have a silly question.
Sure.
Do you mind? It's a stupid question, but it's a...
any questions?
And Anupam, you might be... I mean, it's not directly related to what you say, but you have been insisting on these things and you work very close to experiments. So you might have a... So don't start laughing at my question.
No. We have to brainstorm. So perfectly good
on
question.
On the one hand, you're saying... and you have insisted on that, if gravity is quantum, it just everything is gets entangled. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's true, right? If you start from a wave function which is tensor between system, then you let it evolve, generically entangle with everything. So given that, one would expect that everything is entangled with everything.
That's true.
I remember Lee Smalling telling me that when he was a kid, he learned entanglement. He was thinking that each atom in his body is entangled with atoms all over the galaxy, all that. All right, fine. On the other hand, you do this experiment. You want to probe the quantum nature of gravity by looking at the entanglement of these two particles. But of course, only this works, but because you assume that the two particles to start with are not entangled.
That's true.
So you always take two arbitrary particles. One you take from here, from your left drawer, the other from the right drawer, you start working with them, and they are not entangled. I'm not understanding quantum mechanics. How do the two things go together?
Well, so maybe the right, it's a very beautiful question, to be honest. I say it's a wonderful question. So inherently they are entangled always, but the question is phase, how large the entanglement is. So the way one can realize this only if you create the macroscopic superposition. So inherently, even if you are, as you said, that everything is inherently quantum. Inside the diamond also, my phonons, everything is quantum. It's also getting entangled, that's absolutely correct. But the question is how big the entanglement is in order to, you need to magnify that. That's the reason one has to go to create this macroscopic superposition. It's just purely for measurement purposes. Otherwise, if inherently gravity is quantum, then all of these things are entangled.
So you expect that things by themselves are entangled, but not too much?
Not too much. But you can do one very, very interesting experiment. You can try to change the time delay and try to see when the entanglement is building up. That you can do, but it's extremely, extremely hard. You need a precision.
But in Copenhagen quantum mechanics, what we assume is that before doing the measurement, we do the preparation, and the preparation project the state in some particular state. So mm-hmm. when you just say what you're starting from, you're actually disentangling everything. Is that?
Of course, when you measure things, then in this case, my ruler is spin.
Yeah.
So spin is my ruler. So I could see that whether how many times I get spin up when I take the wave function and close the loop, and how many times in the other side happens with the spin up. So this is the way I'm trying to gather the witness. So spin is my kind of like a ruler. But having said so, all the phonons, all the molecules, everything is entangled. The question is, how do I extract that information?
But you believe that if you take an arbitrary spin particle and another arbitrary spin particle and you make correlations, you do it many times, you have violation of the Bell inequalities?
So this is what we believe. That's the whole point of this correlation, building the correlation.
But if this is so, you're mm-hmm. taking two particles, you're finding violation of the Bell inequalities, this has nothing to do with gravity. They might have been entangled before.
Yeah, but the entanglement phase, you are measuring also the entanglement phase. It's not just the correlation, but also you are measuring how big is the entanglement.
Okay.
So both the things are important. So correlation is important, that how many times you are tossing and seeing heads and tails, but also its magnitude. So both are important for us.
No.
As I said, that even suppose if we don't see gravity, we could also mediate through photons, which is purely a Casimir. So you can get entangled with Casimir also. So in principle, you can also measure that. It's again a weak effect, but experimentally you can measure that.
Thanks.
No.
Maybe to expand on the question of Carl, sure. which I find also interesting. I mean, I want to link it to this idea of no screening. I mean, mm-hmm. The type of experiment we do with photon, they work because we can screen the electromagnetic field. So there's a way to create a preparation of systems where you somehow limit the soft photon and the killer, the entanglement is really the soft photon, right? So this is where, and then you can, you know, create a Faraday cage, right?
Yeah,
and the presence of a Faraday cage means that you can purify your state.
Yeah.
So the fact that it's impossible to create a Faraday cage in gravity, maybe, I don't know, maybe this is how we can test quantum gravity. I mean, in some sense, maybe it's, you see, there's something where gravity, it's true. It's so, because it's unscreenable, you cannot dilute the entanglement, or it seems so. So maybe there's some, you know, smart preparation that, you know, try to, I mean, anyway. So I want to leave the problem of the Calloway race.
No, it's a wonderful question.
Is the absence of Faraday screening, right?
I think what you're asking is a beautiful question. These are absolutely correct. What Carlo's point and your point, they're absolutely correct that the entanglement is there, you cannot screen it. But now the question is the magnitude. How can you extract that information?
Yeah.
That's the place where we are, you know, penalized.
Mm-hmm. But maybe there is a resource here. What I'm saying is that no matter what you do, at the end of the day, most of the entanglement is going to be gravitational.
That's true.
Right? So in some sense, like the major source of entanglement in the world, as a theorist for me, is only gravitation. That's why gravity matters more than the rest. So
absolutely.
So, but how do I see that? How do I see that?
That's the question, exactly.
Personally, this is what I call space-time. Space-time is exactly the result of this, you know, maximum
entanglement. Absolutely. Your philosophy, your thought is absolutely correct. What you're saying is, I agree with you. Now, the question for us is that, how do we extract that?
Yeah, how do you use that as a resource, knowing that you don't have a Faraday cage?
Possibly? Yeah, that's true.
There must be a way around.
There must be, but do you see that this is also a problem that it can also dephase the system, the gravity gradient noise?
Of course.
That's one of the reasons we had to, you know, like go for this, compute this kind of effects. Like even as you said, cars is moving, plane is moving by, or butterfly is going, that is also leading to dephase the system. Now the question is, if I dephase the system, then also performing the experiment becomes harder and harder. So in some sense, it is true that everything is getting entangled inherently, but because of the large size, large objects, they can also dephase the experiment. Okay.
So if we go there, what is the phase of gravity? The phase of gravity is proper time. So, you know, not dephasing the system means that you have very precise clocks. So maybe you should mix what you're describing here with clock technology, like the proper design of quantum clocks. I would say these are exactly, I don't know.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
My intuition of how a clock works is exactly about that. It's about if you assume, if you assume that dephasing is mostly gravitational, then not dephasing is the notion of time. This is the, you know, synchronization.
Yeah, absolutely. If we have a very good precision of clock, we can measure all these dephasing rates.
Okay.
Exactly.
I don't know enough about clock technology, but maybe that's an extra.
No. I mean, these are absolutely good questions, because what you are asking is a perfectly good question. So if I can measure all these dephasing, so in some sense, this accelerometer, this interferometer, is also a very good accelerometer. It can measure any small acceleration.
Mm-hmm.
So if it can measure acceleration, then also it can measure, you know, they can act as a very good quantum clocks in some sense, because I can place it in any curvature and it can measure any small deviation. So these are also very excellent clocks by themselves.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think it's a good point maybe to stop here. And thank you, Anupam, again for...
Thanks. Thank you very much.
Enthusiastic and interesting presentation.
Thanks a lot.